Hi, and welcome to the pool party. This is Jules. I'm your host. Today we have Jana, who is one of my good time, long time friends. We went to Stanford together. We met as freshmen in the same dorm. And today we're talking about art and creativity in academia, but also how to approach long-term creative problems that don't necessarily have a lot of structure to them. I think we both approach this as, me, a designer, creative, who works on my own, but also with the studio, and she has a PhD in sociology at Berkeley, who is writing a PhD dissertation, but also has a lot of free time to structure time. So I think structuring time is really difficult for people these days, especially when it comes to working on long-term projects that become a body of work. And this is something I wanted to talk about because I see a lot of creatives struggle with this. Even myself, still, I have to be kind of strict with my time, and I'm learning flowing, ebbing, whatnot. And I think this is kind of timely for me because I recently took on a few different gigs that are in person. They help provide me with structure, and I think it's done a wonder for my mental health and my quality of work, because for a few years when I was just working remote and taking on freelance projects, it was truly the Wild West, and left to my own devices, I actually get a lot of work done, but it's not necessarily healthy, and I could stray from one direction of either having no work-life balance or, working way too much or partying too much. So recently what I've been doing, I think, has really helped me, and kind of reminds me of being in school sometimes, where I'm in an office a few days a week or teaching class, but then it's not structured by an institution, it's structured by me and basically the 1099 contracts that I agree to, and I like it, frankly. I remember one of my biggest letdowns when I graduated from college and entered the workforce was just how much of my time I could not control. But I actually feel like I have more control over my schedule these days and what kind of projects I say yes to. But there are certain social factors that are really important to me, like agreeing to meet someone at a certain time and place to work in person, approaching work and making contact with it, which is one thing Jana talks about, during certain hours, just to get the brain flowing. It's very structured, and I think those types of ways of moving forward through time are extremely important to get the wheel turning, because there have been moments in my life where I felt run over by the wheel of time. So without further ado, we're talking with Jana today, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Oh, by the way, if you don't know me, my name is Jules. You can go to my website, juliaespero.me, that's juliaespero.me, to check out my portfolio, my work, and let's stay connected. If you haven't already, go ahead and follow this podcast, rate it 5 stars, and listen to it wherever you like podcasts. And if this episode inspires you at all today, feel free to share it with a friend, send it to your mom. I'm sure she'll love it. All right, let's go.
Hey.
I love your maps. How's it going?
Hi. It's good. I also had after I was texting you,
yeah,
when you were asking me what we should talk about, I was going to my car and my car battery died overnight. Shit.
No, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. And so normally Yanni has cables, but he had already gone to work, and so I was literally standing on the street just waiting for people, literally just approaching random people on the street being do you have jumper cables? And eventually this elderly Asian man did, and he was
shout out to him.
Yeah. He was walking with his groceries, and he was okay, yeah, I'll go to my apartment, I'll come back.
Oh, I'm glad someone helped you.
Yeah. Oh. I just don't want to call AAA because they would take forever to come.
They do. They take forever. Anyways, I'm stoked to have you on the podcast again because it's been a year. And yeah. I'm just going to go ahead and start recording, and I'll edit it and send it to you later.
Yeah,
you know, sure. The drill. Jana, thank you for joining me back on the podcast. I know you're writing a PhD thesis this year, and we're going to talk about creativity in academia today. So as a Peggy Goo of academia, what does that mean to you?
So one thing I have to say is that I've started my dissertation. This year, but I won't be finishing until spring 27, mm-hmm. happen.
Oh, wow. Sh
Yeah, because that shit does not happen
Overnight.
anymore. But I'm excited about it. I guess to your opening question, yeah, it's work hard, play hard out here. I feel like my life these days is very much like prioritizing work during the week and then prioritizing play on the weekends. And so I find that it's been really helpful for me because I feel like, especially in academia or any kind of like creative process that takes a while, it's very easy to like let work consume your life. Like you can just, there's always like stuff to do and you can always be working. And I used to do that, but I think now my mode is more like treating my work like a 9 to 5, which is what it really is, and then trying to maintain like a life outside of it and traveling and going to festivals or going out a lot or like hanging out with friends is like really important for me. And then yeah, and I find that like my work is better because of that.
It's like the 9 to 5 schedule really does kind of get you boundaries when you follow it to you can hear my nephews
Oh.
yelling about Super Smash Bros. And Charlie, my dog. I'll give them a second. Oh my gosh, I want to talk to you about Arco Sansi a little bit, but I do have this kind of broader question. Because obviously you're not a white man in academia, so what would you say to the people who think that academia is a white man's club full of intellectuals?
That's a good question. I think that I have a lot of hope in the future of academia because I think that historically, yeah, it's been, it obviously has skewed towards like white men or just white people in general from like Western countries. And even like in it, and the problem with that is that actually it sort of narrows the focus of what people study. I mean, especially in sociology, like if like white people from the Western world are in mostly in the field, then the focus of attention and what's deemed important to study is like what's happening in the West. And so I think that, yeah, so it's not just a problem with diversity. It's like it literally like limits what like sociology could be, so I think that's like the history of that. But I actually have a lot of optimism about the future of like sociology and academia in general because I do see a lot more diverse like grad students. Like pretty much everyone in my cohort and the cohort, like the majority of people in my cohort and the cohorts around me in my program, and I know at other schools, like we're mostly all people of color, actually like majority women, generally with like more progressive values, and not really about this like gatekeeping mentality. I think there's like basically like three generations of like recent academia. So one is obviously like, white elite, people. And then the second generation actually was like maybe like the generation of or two above us where, you're starting to have like the first like Latino woman faculty member. But I think because opportunities are so limited for them and they're quite successful, and it's not that they don't want to help, but they do also kind of have a scarcity mindset around academia or like they take things very personally. They're like, oh, like you're not respecting me because I'm a woman. It's like, no, like it's not because it's like you're also maybe like you don't treat your students well, so like people have a hard time with that. And then I think then there's like this current generation of like up and coming academics that I think yeah, like we kind of have moved away from the scarcity mindset thing and like we know that there's like more than one spot for us in the world. So yeah, that's kind of how I see it. Yeah, so a lot of optimism ultimately.
Yeah, that's so good. And what you just said, because you brought up this point about some people don't treat their students very well. Maybe that's why they're not super liked. It has nothing to do with identity. And I think especially this week, this November, first week of November of 2024, what I've been thinking a lot about is how even in the places I work, like as a practicing designer who sometimes works with like people of all different ages, like professors, people who are like fresh out of college or like have been working for like 10 years, like pre-COVID, in COVID, remote environments, and now in person. Like, it's kind of obvious who's been working and like working in different ways and who hasn't and is like kind of stuck in this idea of like you should just be praised for being older and like having experience. And sometimes I have to check myself too. Sometimes I'm like, am I resting on my laurels? Like, I know I went to Stanford. I know I did like a lot of training. I know I work pretty hard, but like at the end of the day, you're only as good as like your ability to function on a team sometimes. So, yeah, I mean, like, what are your thoughts on that? I'm thinking about humility and what that really means and maybe how it works functionally, but some people don't aspire to be humble, so.
I mean, I think I was just talking about this morning with a friend in the cohort in my department, but I think we're like in a really we're in a period where people are like, I think, quite sensitive about a lot of things. And I think, and I say sensitive in the sense that I don't know if people are actually like receptive to feedback and like learning from it, because people tend to take things so personally. And they always say, like, when people are giving you feedback, you should like, even if the other, like, regardless of the person who's giving you feedback, what their intentions are, you should always approach it as like they're critiquing your work and not you. Like, I feel like that's like the bottom line. And I feel like, yeah, like, I think this goes to like your humility thing, because I think it actually is like a very prideful thing to like take someone's honest feedback to you so personally and be like, oh, like they're just being a bitch, or like they don't like me. But it's like, no, like maybe if you had more humility, you can actually look at your work from like someone else's point of view and like at least try to understand where that came from, rather than like, yeah, taking things so personally and like, so, and ultimately not changing or learning. You know, it's not to say like you have to like change entirely who you are, but I think it's important to like constantly learn and like adapt and grow. Like, I just think that's the problem right now with like, even if like on a work team or when you're getting feedback on a paper, or like you're making an art piece and you're getting feedback, like you're just never gonna not get feedback. I think, yeah. So that's how I kind of view it.
And I think feedback is kind of a precious thing too, because like you can work by yourself for sure, but there's always, I think for me, sometimes like imposter syndrome is this nagging thought of like, I don't know what I don't know. But if you just like open your mind to let people critique you and take it kind of is soothing. You're like, okay, I considered other people's thoughts and I tried, and that's really all you can do.
I agree.
So your paper is going to take about, we're in 2024, 2027, that's when you aim to have it done. Damn. What's the process of that like? And what is it about?
So my dissertation is actually three papers. So the way that dissertations, at least in my field, kind of work is that you either like write like a book length dissertation where it's like basically the first draft of the book you're going to publish, or you like write three papers that like fit together in a certain way and you can just like staple them together, and that's your dissertation. So I think I'm going like the three paper route. And so it's broadly about like the emergence of sustainability in global climate governance. So how are organizations and people like adapting to climate change through the lens of like sustainability work? So I'm trying to look at this from sort of like, it's called like polycentric, but you could think of it as kind of like a nested Russian doll kind of perspective. So the first paper kind of looks at it at an international like historical level. So like, how did this idea of like sustainability come about? Because we know that it took a while for like climate change to like take hold as a concept. So then subsequently, like, how did the idea of sustainability as a response to climate change play out? And so it's, the first is a more historical paper. The second paper kind of like, okay, looks specifically at companies and corporations and these organizations, and looking at these different sort of like competing logics and visions around sustainability. So one view is like, to be sustainable, we have to like completely kind of reduce consumption, degrowth the economy. Like, we can't hinge our economic growth on consumption. That's just simply, you know, bad for the environment. We have to like completely change the way we do our economy. And there's another view that's like, okay, it's possible for like our current capitalist system to still exist, and we could just like make it better. So it's basically like abolition versus reform, right? And so I've been doing a lot of like interviews and have a lot of data on like companies all around the world, and just looking at, you know, what kind of policies are working, does that actually reduce emissions, and sort of these different like logics at play. And then the third, like, so the inside nested all is looking at people within companies, right? So so just as a summary, right, we have the international, then we have organizational level, now we're looking at people inside companies. And I think the main thing I'm very curious about is like, okay, so companies are actually hiring a lot more like sustainability professionals. They're hiring like chief sustainability officers, like sustainability directors. Like, this has been a growing field, and mm-hmm. it will continue to be, I think, despite the election. And so I'm just curious, you know, like for these people who have these roles, like how do they sort of square their personal values on sustainability with the or sort of organizational demands of their job, right? So like, for example, I was interviewing like sustainability directors at large mining companies in Australia, or like Chevron, or like, you know, sometimes companies in really bad sectors. And actually, I think what's really interesting is that a lot of the people in these roles, they actually mean really well. Like, they're not like evil people who want to like ruin the world. Like, they actually, they view that like they can make change like within the company, and it's maybe more impactful to like have that role in, you know, an oil and gas company than like, you know, recycling company, for example. And so yeah, so I've just been interviewing people who work in sustainability, how they sort of navigate their jobs and their values and their identities, you know, like when do they have to compromise their values and when do they not have to. So yeah, so that's the overall, what my dissertation's about, which kind of sounds like a lot, but, yeah, I would say like two of the three papers are already done. So I just have like,
sweet. You're tracking along. So wait, which one is left for you to write?
The first one, like the historical one.
Historical one. Oh, that is a broad. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the hardest part actually was like interviewing companies, like getting companies to like talk to me about climate change is like, you might imagine, kind of hard. And so I spent like the last like 2 years like literally cold emailing like hundreds of companies. Like, I had this like database of like companies that report their emissions to their investors, and so I started there, and then I would literally like Google every single company and then pull up their sustainability reporting. Because what you might not know is that companies now put out both financial reports and sustainability reports. Like, it's like a thing now. And so I would go through the sustainability reporting and like look if there's like a contact email in that report, like an office, like a sustainability office email or something. And if there was an email, I would just like send them this cold email and try to get an interview. And so, yeah, so it was this very like tedious process. But yeah, I've been able to talk to like around 70 people or companies on this topic. So I feel good with like the number of interviews I have on that. And then in terms of like professionals in the workplace on that, I think I've talked to like almost 40 people on that. So more than like 100 interviews on this topic. And, you know, as you might know, like, I don't know, like analyzing interviews also takes a while. So yeah, so that's what I spent most of my year doing. So actually the historical piece, I haven't done it yet, but it feels a lot easier because I don't have to depend on like other people taking the time to talk to me. I can just like do that on my own time.
yeah, that is actually, I totally agree with you. When I used to write papers, it's like, yeah, you can kind of just like digest what has happened, like analyze it from a new perspective, considering current context. But then like present day qualitative interviews, well, those are really challenging for me because I'm curious, like, what are some of the themes you're looking at? Are there like notable quotes that come up? What strikes you?
Yeah, so the one I always say is that I interviewed the first director of sustainability at like the largest electric utilities company in the Czech Republic. And she made this interesting comment where she said that, so she was like the first person hired for this role. They like created this role and then she was the first person hired for it. And she made this comment that she said that she believes that she was hired because she has more of a background actually in academic research. And so she, you know, has a very data-driven approach to everything. And she said that like the CEO of the company wanted someone who would treat sustainability as like a data like a technological problem and not an ideological thing. Like, that's like a direct quote. She's like, sustainability is, you know, a data problem. It's not ideological. And I think that would strike people as surprising because, you know, obviously there's a lot of activism around climate change. It, like, everything is like ideological, including like how you view climate change and what should be done about it. So it's interesting that for a large part, because of the sort of emerging regulations around companies and climate change, it is treated kind of like a technological data-driven problem. So what I mean by that is basically the main regulation we have right now on companies and climate change is that companies are actually, any publicly listed company in most countries with like, you know, developed economies, they pretty much have to report their emissions, like emissions accounting, to the SEC, like to the securities regulator. So it's not like they have to report to the EPA. It's like the literal US Securities and Exchange Commission is like requiring this. So companies always have to report every year on their like financials to the SEC, right? And so they're starting to have to do this as well with emissions. So this is like quite legitimate regulation. Like, it's not, they're not bullshitting around here. And this is the same in EU. This is the same in like Japan, New Zealand, like all over. And so companies have to report this. And I think overall it is a good thing, right? Like, there should be like reporting and transparency so that once you start reporting your emissions, there's a way to like track it and you should overall be reducing it. But I think that sometimes, as with like a lot of like solutions that we try to throw at problems, like, you know, when you actually talk to people at companies and you're saying like, okay, do you think that collecting all this data, like, is it actually like changing, you know, emissions or changing what a company's doing? A lot of the times, like, you talk to these sustainability people and they say that they spend so much time basically like crunching numbers on emissions on Excel and like doing all this like emailing in the company to like get data on emissions that the most of the effort actually just goes towards like reporting their emissions and like just fulfilling these like disclosure requirements rather than like actually reducing your emissions, right? It's like they're just trying to like comply with regulations now, which overall is like a good thing, but if whether or not it actually like addresses the goals of it, which is to reduce emissions because the earth is still warming up, like, it's kind of a more mixed picture, right? And so yeah, so that's kind of, yeah, like one of the main things that I've been finding in my research. So, yeah, and I think one thing I would add too is that like on a broader scale, I think it's been really, really fascinating to actually like look directly at corporations and what they're doing about climate. Because I think, especially in sociology, like the focus in sociology is very much on like inequality. So you're often studying like sort of marginalized minority groups or, you know, divisions across class, gender, race, things like that. And those are all super important. I think oftentimes, like whenever you say like, yeah, I'm studying companies and climate change, people will be like, why? Like, companies aren't going to do anything, right? Like, why even bother looking at them? And I think I definitely also had that take going in. I was like, why would I do that? Like, obviously it's all bad. But actually, I think like the more you actually look at it, first of all, you have to like look at it, because if we're actually going to do anything about climate change, especially like if we're not addressing like the largest emitters, like what are you going to look at, you know? So I think it's important to like actually look at what companies are doing. And second of all, once you actually start getting into it, like you see that it's a much more complex picture. Like there is like some good that's happening. There's also like some bad that's happening. There's also some where it's like, people are just trying to figure it out. That doesn't mean that the people in these companies are like evil, like capitalist pigs, you know? Like, I think that people just like really are trying to do better. And like, sometimes it's just kind of like the nature of like surviving in our economy. Like, companies want to survive as well. So I just think it's a lot more complicated, which makes it really interesting to look at, like, yeah, in my view.
Yeah, actually, I really agree. I think, wow. It almost sounds like an accounting problem, like a mass accounting problem at the moment. And I think that is a good thing, especially for companies where like the bottom line is oftentimes the issue. And so then when you put like a quantity on something like carbon or sustainability and you can then measure it, at least gives you a baseline for change. I think recently, this past week, from a branding and marketing perspective. I got on a call with the CEO, their team, and my team that I work with. And it was interesting because we wanted to talk broadly about values as a brand in terms of sustainability, maybe some of the values that people get from this consumer product good, like whether that's like true sustainability in terms of creating the product, or like cleanliness and not like having to, you know, like I'm trying to be broad because I don't want to talk about this product specifically, but some people use like washcloths, for example, and washcloths aren't actually that clean, but there are, you know, ways of like maybe, you know, purchasing a product, maybe it costs you more money, but if it lasts longer and it's actually like healthier for you, then maybe that is like a true reflection of value and like a good way of spending money. And I think when it comes to value and the way that I see people like invest their time and money lately, I think bringing it back to like an arts perspective as well, what I see sometimes is like a reluctance for people to receive money in exchange for their work and like their value. And I'm like, money isn't inherently evil. I think it's like actually, you know, what do you get out of this and like what exchange is happening? And I see a lot of times like a reluctance for people to even do any sort of exchange when it comes to like goods and services because they don't want to call their art or their creativity like a good or a service. But I think if we kind of just like bring it back to the baseline of like, well, if I'm exchanging like money for something that you do, like we can define values with language, but maybe like the quantity of like exchanging money and like recording it is important, even though it doesn't feel like supernatural.
I think, basically, like money and also like data are like a means, and people treat it like an end, and I think that like complicates a lot of like our work and our relationships.
Yeah, it's really tough too because I'm like, is there ever really an end? No. That's like kind of what I'm starting to feel lately. I'm like, yeah, you can see something as a means to end, but there's never truly an end. So like, what is that actually? I don't. Yeah, things keep on going. You can only observe like results. So from a historical perspective, like what is the first piece of history you're looking at for your third paper?
I think the first one basically just starts with like the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Actually, I have to look at my notes.
92, baby. Yeah. This is the birth year of my ex. Anyways, let's go.
Wait, oh my God.
Relatively recent too, because so I'm a 96 baby, I'm 28, 92, that is like 32 years ago. These are incredibly relevant years.
So actually, okay, sorry. The first one actually is, I had to look up the year. The first one is 1987, actually.
87,
So, this was like the first time like a formal definition was made for sustainability. This was basically a report that came out of one of like the like global meetings they were starting to set up. And they defined sustainability as, quote, meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Yeah, it's kind of broad, but also I think it, like, I think people agree on this definition, but like in very different ways, because some people would be like, oh, we have to meet the needs of the future generation by like conserving the planet. And then other people would be like, we have to meet the needs because like they're like, we have to like still have like capitalism and, competition and blah, blah, blah. So I think, so I think that's where it kind of starts. And then, that was 1987. And then it just kind of like ratchets up from there with like the 92 Rio Earth Summit, and then all these like sort of global meetings that happen every year, like the COP, COP 26, 27, 28, and the UN, and like, all these like global meetings. And so, it's definitely like interesting. I don't know, like I feel like if I were to keep like yapping about this, I would also say that like I think that, I don't know if I've like talked about this before, but I believe that like the idea of like the global is like a recent invention, because for like, you know, most of like human history, you like existed within like your local context, right? And I really think that, or like I actually not think, like I know that we didn't actually have this concept of the global until like after both world wars and in the rise of like the Cold War, when we started literally sending people to space, and then you could actually have the technology to like take a picture of the Earth. And that picture of the Earth, which if you think about it as a concept, like we kind of take it for granted now, like we have social media, like everything just feels like global, international, but like that just like was not the case, like that we did not have that technology like 70 years ago for that. And so once like images of the whole Earth started becoming circulated, and we started having things like TV and like radio and stuff, like over time, like we have this idea of the global. And I talk about this because that sort of laid the path for having things like the UN and like being able to have like international agreements on climate, which are super important, you know, like, and like our interdependence on other countries and other places, like in our current economy. And so, yeah, so I think it's important for like dealing with these global problems that we have. And also it's important because I think it's crazy that like people now are like all around the world are like going against like the global, they're becoming more insular, like nationalism's on the rise, like Trump is gonna like impose tariffs and other countries are doing the same. And so I think like there's been this backlash against the global, and I think it's important to like emphasize like how important it is. Like we're at a point where we can't reverse back to like, you know, we just living in our context. Like it sounds nice and like, you know, yeah, living off your land and from your own country, but like it's, I don't think we can go back to that. Like we're so dependent like globally.
The homestead mindset is like super, I think, fantastical, charming, bucolic, pretending like you're in the Little House on the Prairie, like living in modern day Idaho. But even if you want that, it's like your machinery, like the parts are being made abroad. Like you cannot excuse yourself from a global context. And yeah, I think when I think about like globalism and the economy, we're literally operating from a unit of one. If the Earth is like a unit, that's mm-hmm. one. You could break that down into like whatever metrics you want. But I think that first quote that you mentioned, like trying, what is it exactly? Could you repeat it?
It's meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs.
Yeah, I don't know. That strikes me as like a budget. It's like, yeah, are yeah. you gonna bet your load like at the slots in Vegas today? It's like probably not a good idea if you're trying to yeah. meet the needs of the future. You kind yeah. of have to invest in what is needed today. And I don't know if yeah. we've been doing that, frankly, yeah. with yeah. our money.
Yeah.
As a country, as a society. Yeah. But it's worth noting. Yeah. I think that's like where some of those like themes of human values on a personal level come in. It's like what people believe will happen. And sometimes there's this nihilism and this idea that there isn't necessarily a future that leads to like poor spending habits. As I've like educated myself on personal finance, but I think that is like super applicable even when I see the way people spend. And like new industries, like we're talking to this one client that might be like luxury space travel. And I've noticed that like that's come up a lot too, because, you know, there's always like this thought of like, you know, maybe people are not really willing to accept globalism, but they're almost like more willing to accept like this idea of like outside the Earth. And I'm like, wait a second. I feel like that's more than we've shown ourselves capable of digesting.
When you were saying like spending, like people's like spending habits, because obviously there's like, you can't blame people because like there's so much uncertainty, and so like why not just like take care of your what you want today, because like mm-hmm. the future is so like uncertain, so it's like an obvious response. But like I actually have this like working theory that like I think our next like major or like huge financial crisis is going to come from platforms like buy now pay later, because I think like the rise of those things, like it's so dangerous because people simply cannot afford the things that they are like trying to do, and it's such a consumer trap. Like at least like when, I don't know, when we were coming up and like we got credit cards, it was like, don't buy something that like you don't think you can 100% pay back. And okay, sure, a lot of people have credit card debt, but then now this is at a layer of like, okay, with your online shopping, you can just like do like 4 installments of like $50 like each month, and it feels a lot more affordable. But what happens when people en masse can't start paying it back, and then these lenders can't pay back like their banks, like that's going to lead to like some kind of crisis, I think, like at least in the
You're
US.
not wrong. I think it's kind of like happening too, like in real time slowly, because I knew people, so anecdotally, that were making so much money just off of like selling content or like selling services like photography, even in 2020, because there was this mass panic of like, oh no, we can't like work in person, better go digitally. But now, like 4 years later, there's no longer this pressure of like, oh, I need to have like a digital presence. If anything, people have like built up a digital presence. And if they're still overspending, then like they don't want to put more money towards things like digital services. And if they suddenly like made a bunch of money and like bought a bunch of things like with Affirm or like buy now, pay later, it's like we're running up on that now. It's like, do you have the same amount of money coming in as you did? And if you're like a photographer who was making way more like 4 years ago than now, it's kind of scary. It's like you might have to file for bankruptcy. Yeah.
So I don't know, we'll see what
We will
happens.
see. We will see what happens very quickly.
Problem too is that
Yeah.
like my advisor at Berkeley actually like had this paper a few years ago where he said that like he argues that like the main reason why the Fed overlooked the markers for like the 2008 crisis was because all our frames for a financial crisis were based on like sort of traditional finance. So like growth, like inflation, like employment, like those like sort of classic indicators. But they had sort of completely overlooked like how much of the American economy relied on like housing and like mortgages and like loans. And so like he sort of showed through analyzing like all like the Fed meetings leading up to the financial crisis that like this was brought up by a very small minority of economists on the staff, but it was like overshadowed by people who were like, no, like that's outside like economics, like that won't lead to a crisis, but like it did. So people like often overlook like how people are actually spending their money and like, you know, like how people actually accrue debt like on scale. And so I think, yeah, so like now we know obviously, okay, so now the Fed is like aware of like housing, but like I don't know how they're aware of like, you know, other areas like buy now pay later, or even like money tied up in like, you know, crypto or like betting markets and, you know, sports gambling. There's so many things that people are doing to like stay afloat in our economy. And I think, yeah, if you're just like, you know,
That's
I think
such a
people are
good
like detached.
point. It is kind of like a cam, it's like it's gambling. It's like concerning how many people make money just from gambling. And then when your emotions are involved in it, and it isn't actually like super predictable. Yeah, actually, these are like my shower thoughts. I'm like, wait. So like when our tax system was created, I'm sure they had no idea that like crypto dick butts and these like coins called like Shiba and Bonk would just like make people like millionaires overnight. Like, I don't think these people are paying their taxes either. Like, why are we chasing waitresses who make like $500 in one night? It's like nothing in comparison. Okay, cool. Well, so with all that being said, recently you went to a festival. How was it? What were your favorite things about it? Could you tell us about it? And would you go again?
So recently I went to this music festival called Forum Arcosanti, and it's at this place called Arcosanti in Arizona, and it's basically like a experimental town created by this architect, and they were trying to combine like architecture and ecology. So it's like a very like beautifully designed building sort of set in what's like around what's called like the Verde Valley in Arizona. It's like this beautiful stretch of like canyons in Arizona. And the place actually now makes a lot of their sort of revenue from like hosting like farm to table workshops during the year, or they have a year-round volunteer program. And they also actually are a foundry, so they make bells. So they make these like iron bells, which I actually bought. And so that's like what it's like today. And actually, what the cool thing about Arcosanti, I have to say, is that it's entirely like volunteer built. So they have a foundation, but like it's kind of like reflecting the sort of like hippie back to the land like commune kind of era. And so yeah, so I think that's like the kind of like crowd it still kind of attracts to this day. And so every year they have this music festival called Form. I think it started in 2015 maybe. It's like a pretty small festival, so it's like maybe 2,000 people total. And just for comparison, like last week I went to go see Keshanada, like a normal sort of big artist concert in Berkeley, and the crowd was 10,000 people. So normally concerts can have like 10,000 people in one night. This entire festival is 2,000 people, so it's really, really small. And they always have like really, you know, big artists come through, and I liked it because actually it was like a very diverse slate of artists. So it wasn't just EDM, it wasn't just like, you know, like rock music.
So they're a foundry. Does that mean like ironworking? You bought a bell.
Yeah, ironworking. This is really dumb. Oh, Shabaka, who's like a really talented like flutist. And so there's like a flute artist. There was like a spoken word artist named
I
Asia
love
Monet,
that.
who would like do spoken word with like a band behind her. So there's like music accompanying in the back. Like I literally cried like during one of her like song or like poems, because the poem was called like For the Kids, and she's talking about like kids who like, you know, get their lives like cut short, their opportunities cut short because of like the society we live in. And so there was like spoken word, there was like these like super talented pianists, there was yeah, just like a lot of diverse music. And yeah, it was a really cool event. And I think what was really interesting about this festival compared to other ones is that there's like no VIP, and like the line between artists and people in the crowd is very, very thin. It's like one of the only festivals I think where like when the artist isn't performing, they're literally just like at the festival. They're like in the crowd, which I've never seen ever. Because normally, especially when most places have like VIP, because you know that's how festivals make money. Like if an artist is at the festival, they're probably in the VIP section.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so I've been to festivals through friends who are artists where I've had the privilege of going backstage and then like hanging out around artists who are just chilling. It's like one of the nicest experiences, actually, because you get to kind of see their side where they're like really hanging out and then they're like preparing mentally and then kind of like hyping each other up. And then I truly wish there are more experiences like that, but it really requires people to be like kind of chill enough around people who create to understand like the emotional vulnerability that it takes to like just relax and then literally have to perform afterwards or like vice versa.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of probably says something about form and like the environment that they create where people are willing to do that.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
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 That was cool. I would probably, yeah, I would try to keep going every year. I would say like the top favorite is still like Burning Man. I think Burning Man.
Such different scales of festivals, though, and like
Yeah, I think
requirements
Burning Man's
for
like 80,000
participating,
people.
right?
Yeah, I would say like, yeah, I think that, I mean, I think like I had a way better time at Forum than like at Burning Man. They're like different, but like I would say Burning Man's still probably my favorite because it quite literally is like the template that like a lot of these other festivals try to be like, and it really is like it's like the source of like, you know, a lot of like the creativity that you see at these other sort of like festivals. And so it's hard to like honestly say like, okay, Form is better just because they're so different, you can't really compare it. But like I think you see like the clear sort of lines that have come out of Burning Man, and Form is one of them. I think there's like a lot of like burners at Form, like from there's a lot of burners in like Phoenix apparently, and you get a lot of people from like LA and the Bay, so it's like that kind of crowd. So yeah, so it was good. And yeah, I feel like I always come back from like festivals like I don't know, like I personally don't really like I feel like my biggest maybe like flex is that like I don't really get like depressed or like
I was about to say
I'm not tired after festivals. I'm like way more motivated,
energized.
energized. Yeah, even if I was, you know, like doing a lot of stuff at these festivals, like I actually always come back like a lot more like, yeah, motivated. And I think that's why like it's like really important to me to continue just like having fun and like sort of connecting, because it makes my work better.
Yeah, I'm curious. So, like, what's your internal dialogue like when you're at a festival and you're coming back and you know you have like work coming up? Because I truly believe that sometimes like thought patterns are replicable. So, what's your inner dialogue like? Or is there just like no thoughts? You're just vibing.
Yeah, well, actually, like I actually like do a lot of like background thinking about my work, and I actually reflect a lot on like where I like sort of like my progress and like where I started from. So I think like I'm actually quite literally always like thinking thoughts in the club, like and I think a couple years ago, I definitely had like very like negative self-talk. I'm always like, you know, like it's hard not to, like when you're thinking about like your work and you're like, oh, I still have to do this, and like why didn't I do this, and blah, blah, blah. So that's very natural. I think like over the years, I don't do that really like at all anymore. I don't think it's productive on like my energy. I mean, sometimes it still happens, but like I can like get out of it pretty quickly now. But I think so it kind of, so like when I'm thinking thoughts in the club, like I like have two sort of streams. So one is I do think practically like, okay, like what have I done so far? What's left to be done? I'm thinking about like different ways to sort of solve like these problems that I'm like puzzles that I'm seeing in my work, and like how do I like analyze it this way or that way. So I'm definitely thinking in the background, but on the other hand, I'm not coming at it from a place of like blame or self-hatred or shame or anything or guilt. Like it's very much like I honestly like think a lot about like, I don't know, just like how much progress I made. Like I'm like so proud of myself for like, you know, continuing to do this. I think about like how far I've come from like how I used to sort of, I had a much more like toxic relationship with like myself and my work. And I think you can relate. Like I'm definitely someone where I wish my identity and self-worth was not tied to work. But the thing is like, as we talked about this morning, like I'm a Capricorn and Taurus stellium. I have six planets, three in Capricorn, three in Taurus. So it is true that
You
like
just gotta keep on climbing. I think we're hardwired for it too. I think it's like from a young age somewhere, like we were like praised for output and then we're also good at it. And so it's
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
well, let me,
You
you know, when
never
you're a
want to,
child,
like
you're
you
like, let
want
me
to
just see how far I can go with this. And then
yeah.
literally like almost 3 decades later, you're like, oh fuck, like I could literally keep on going, but it's not always healthy. So you have to like kind of then start working backwards where it's like, how do I save myself from this?
So anyway, so those are like my two like streams. Like I am always like, 'cause I don't know, it's like I think it's hard not to like just like think about thing, like just problems that you're trying, not to say like I have a problem in my work, but just like I very much, it's kind of like a math problem. Like I'm just puzzling over like this
Yeah,
problem.
work is essentially a problem. There's that problem, and then there can be a larger problem outside of work. But I think that's like what a lot of people strive to avoid.
And then yeah, so that's one stream, and the other stream is like just being like, wow, like I think I did the best I could, and like this is awesome and I love myself, yay. And so that's sort of my two streams. And so yeah, like I think when it comes to the other part of your question, which is like how do you like sort of go back to your work like during the week and stuff, like I think like over the years I've actually developed, I could write a whole book on this, I think, like which I might do actually one day,
It's
but like
so valuable, yeah.
I have a bunch of like methods that I do that like I stick to, and that's how I sort of bring my brain back. And so for example, one thing that I was sort of mentioned at the beginning was like being strict about my boundaries. So just because, you know, I just came back from traveling or whatever, like, and it's Monday, like I don't have to start at exactly 9 a.m., but like I do get my work started at some point that morning, like 10 or 11. Like just even like sitting down and pulling up your stuff again from like Friday and just like sitting with it, I think it always kind of gets like the creative juices flowing. Like I very much view it as similar to like an artist like going to their studio every day. Like some days you're like super productive in the studio, but other days like you just have to sit there and like tinker around. Like not everything is gonna be like a final product that the world sees, but like the process of thinking about your things, like experimenting with something. That's like all part of the process as well. Like in academia, you're running this analysis on something and the results you're getting are like not a result. Like it's not a result you wanted. It's not a result that means anything, but no result is still a result because now you like know a little bit more about the thing you're studying. And so you can kind of like think about what to do next. So I think it's important to just always sit with it. And so I actually call this method contact hours because I think that a lot of time when we're dealing with like a big project, like we think that, oh, like if okay, like I have so much anxiety about it, like you're procrastinating. And like I think for me, like I just literally have to like open the project and just make some contact with it, you know? And I think like that's always better than like not touching your project at all because like you're so scared about it. Like you and the more you procrastinate, like the worse it gets, right? And so it's like you just have to like
You're creating
literally.
distance instead of like contact, which is what you're doing. Just
That's the contact
exposing
hour.
yourself.
And so that's like one thing. And then another thing that I've started doing like 2 years ago that I no one like taught me, but like I like think it's like a really good method is like I actually keep like basically like a journal tracking every single day that I've been working. And I kind of got this idea from STEM, like the sciences, because in STEM they have like a lab notebook. And every time you're in the lab, you like write down what you did and like how it went and you know what to do next. And no one in the social sciences has ever talked about doing that. And I think that for me it's really helpful because every day I base and like these are notes that like only I see. So like, like you can write whatever you want. And so every day I just kind of like whatever I'm doing, I just kind of document it. And I'm like, okay, like this is my thought process right now. Like, this is what I'm trying to do, blah, blah, blah. Because it's important because when you take your mind to do other things, like have fun and stuff, like bringing your mind back to like where you were at the end of the week before, it's like really hard sometimes. Like, I'm always like pulling up what I did before to be like, okay, what was I doing? And how do I continue building off that? So just like tracking your thought process, like journaling, like keeping like a some kind of documentation. And I feel like this is, relevant to you because like you're an artist and designer as well. Like just documenting your work is like so important. I think that social scientists forget to do that or like don't do that. And so I started doing that like 2 years ago. And I think the last thing that I think is really important is like, and I think that this goes back, so it's like there's contact hours, there's like, journaling about your process, but that the last part is like really like valuing your time. So like I think especially when you're doing creative work or any work where like no one's gonna like harp on you if you don't badge into your building at like 8 a.m. It's not like a finance job, right? Like you kind of can do this work like kind of from anywhere. The boundaries are a lot more blurred. I think that so I have this thing where it's like okay, like just because like I'm technically free at like 10 a.m. On this day, like I know that like my brain works the best from like 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And so those are like my really important hours that like I only reserve like for myself and only if there's like special circumstances or like if there's absolutely no other time that something can happen, like then I like schedule things that other people want to do during that time. But you have to like protect your time basically. Because it's very easy to be like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna do this because like I'm free. But like I kind of treat like my work hours as like appointments with myself. And I find that to be very helpful, especially like I don't know, in grad school or academia in general, it's like people are always asking you to do like free work for them, like doing in the, going to this meeting, like serving on this committee, like that's all fine. But like I don't want that to happen during my special hours. So those happen to be like my special hours, but like I think it's important to figure out like what your own hours are. Like some people are like more night owls and they work better in the night. So like that could be their protected time, but you just have to like know yourself and know how you work and how you think and cater to that. So like I'm not saying like, oh, you have to like wake up at 7 a.m. and like do all the things like morning person. Like, I think you just have to find like whatever works best for you and like kind of just go with that. And I
You
think
have to respect it and
people.
honor it. And I think, to your point about not having shame when you're at the club and enjoying yourself, I think one thing that I find so interesting is like a lot of people think sometimes that like being exceptional at your work means not doing things like having fun and going out and maybe basically following off the beaten path. There's like a very straight edge way of doing work. And it doesn't have anything to do with like substances. It's just this idea of what people think successful people look like. And I think that's like a really unfortunate way of just approaching life and like being exceptional, because you're allowing someone to define like what you should be proud of, when really it's the most like innate joys are self-defined. And I think with academia, only did an undergrad, but I appreciate how professors and TAs have office hours. It's like these are the times that like I'm going to take calls. And as an artist, I have my podcast hours and I only do them on Mondays and Fridays. And then I have my studio time and times like where I take sales calls, and those are all separate, and that kind of helps me.
And it's important too, because especially when you're like juggling different like responsibilities and different hats, like I think it's so unproductive to be like at your sales job, but like worried about your design job or worried about your podcast. Like it's important to separate our time out like that, because then you're like, okay, like I'm at my design job. Like I only think about my design stuff here. I'm doing my podcast. Like I'm thinking about podcast stuff here. And then once you're out of that time frame, like you don't have to like keep mulling over it, you know? Like I think,
Yeah, it's like we gotta move on, move forward, because like the wheel keeps on turning. If I get stuck, it's like, well, I'm gonna get run over. That's how I feel. Like we're all like little spokes in the wheel, but if you get stuck, sometimes you get run over. You're not like moving forward.
So I don't know. I think that's why I was like interested in just like talking about like the creative process and everything. I think like there's a lot that we have in common, even though we day to day do like very different things. But I think like a lot of people like kind of wouldn't see like how academic research could be creative, especially in like the more science or like STEM fields. But I think it's really important to like bring it back to a place of like art and
It so
creativity.
is though too, because I know in the work you do, you're synthesizing quite a bit, and as an artist, I synthesize too. I'm mood boarding, I'm remixing, and I think like you're doing that too from like a factual perspective, like topically for your purposes in academia. It's like kind of different lanes, but I think process is so important in the arts. Otherwise, you're just kind of like, I don't know, it's like, what are you asking me to like really pay attention to? Like, how can I see you improve? It's, yeah. So that's what I admire, is process and improvement.
I agree. I think like one of the like hard lessons I learned early on in grad school was like there was definitely a time where I was like very focused on like outcomes. Like I wanted to win all these like fellowship awards. I wanted to like do all these things. And the thing with like getting these like fancy fellowships that like, you know, pay for a year of grad school or whatever is that like just because you get the award doesn't mean that like you're actually gonna like do the work that it needs to like get a just like finish your dissertation. You know, like people are so focused on like having these fancy titles, but like I don't know if they're always like that focused on like actually doing the work. Because that was definitely me. Like I was like putting so much work in into like packaging myself in a certain way for these fellowships when I was like, wait, like the point of me getting a PhD is not to win a fellowship. The point of my getting a PhD is to like collect and synthesize knowledge and like contribute a new aspect to what we already know in our world. Like that's the whole point of like any PhD. It's about like doing your research. Just because you win a fellowship, that can help you. That can definitely help you do your research. Like you know, you're paying for your grad school or whatever. But like
Oh yeah.
automatically mean you're gonna do the work.
Yeah, recognition, like monetary rewards, they serve different purposes, but I think there is like again an innate sense of gratification from following a process, being able to stick to it and continue. And I think like as I get older, I'm not super old, but I'm like I want to keep on doing this when I'm like 60, 70, 80 maybe. And it's gonna require different physical The requirements will physically be different just based upon how my body is. But if I can learn to respect my physicality now, then that's everything to me. I don't want to just be someone who like gets aplomb or fame for like crashing out, because that's what so many people want, kind of. And I'm like, wait, I think that's broken. I think that's a broken system. Attention isn't always good, you know? Like, What's the point?
I don't know. I very much, I have this, like, I'm also like, you know, we're the same age, and like, obviously, like, we're not super old, but when I like look back on like my life so far, like, it might not seem like this on the outside, because yeah, like on paper, right, like we both like went to Stanford, we like obviously like succeeded, and some would say peaked like early, but actually I would say that like I've had like multiple, like I have this joke now that's kind of not a joke, it's real, where like I'm genuinely trying to peak like every decade, because there were definitely periods where like I was flopping like every decade of my life. Like there were periods of like flopping, like yeah, I got into Stanford, you know, after high school, but like when actually at Stanford I was big flop era, like had no direction, like truly a terrible student,
could not agree more.
And then like literally like I just like kind of got my shit together, just like, you know, and then I like had another peak where like, you know, I got into like a PhD program, and then I think a lot of, I don't know, like I don't want to throw shade, but like there are a lot of people I know, especially growing up in like the competitive Bay Area landscape, who I can, again, no shade, everyone has like different goals in life, but like from my perspective, like I think they like peaked once and a little too early, and like just, I don't know, just like never, and I think this goes back to what we were saying of like being willing to change and like adapt to your environment. Like they kind of were like, okay, let me do the Stanford thing, like let me just like go into tech, and then it's like, what, you know, like
they, no get one's so like boring, they get so boring. Yeah. It's like they like applaud themselves for being these intellectuals and big thinkers, and I'm like, well then why are you doing the same thing as everyone else? It becomes like this conformity thing. I was talking to a friend about this the other day, where I was like, you know, sometimes like if you're not careful, you get a little bit too close to the sun, and then it's still like you achieved all these things, but it's still like Jersey Shore up at the top. There's a Jersey Shore at the top, you know, where people are just like competing for like the best baby daddy, and I don't really, that's like not what I want for my life.
Like my favorite example is like, yeah, coming up from like competitive area landscape, like there's this thing called like the Intel Science Fair, which is like essentially the Nobel Prize for high schoolers. Like if you win it, you're like going to MIT, and like I knew people who like I had grown up with who like won the Intel, and the thing is that like the reality is that like usually their parents or someone they know like set them up in a lab and like basically did the research for them and then just slapped their name on it, but whatever, but they're considered to be like smart people and they end up going to like the top schools. And my issue is that like, okay, yeah, like that's great, obviously these kids are like very smart, very hardworking, whatever, but like I would say like most of the people I know who went through Intel did not end up getting PhDs, did not actually end up going into research. Like they just like did that to like get into Stanford and then stopped, you know? So I'm like, what is the point of that?
That is a shame to me, because it's like a lot of like the world changing stuff happens like after that. It's like, finish your thought, like keep going, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying it's like, I just think like, I'm not trying to throw shade at like, I'm not saying like judging people for like what I think that peaking too early. I just think that like people are not necessarily like trying to challenge themselves to like continue to grow, and like everyone's metrics for like what growth means to them is obviously very different, but like I feel like people kind of, I don't know, like tend to want to rest on their laurels, like rest on like the one time they did something well. But like I know for a fact that for me, like if I just rested on the fact that like I went to Stanford undergrad, I would not have like reach other peaks later on in life that like I didn't even know were possible for me until I like started challenging myself to like see what else is out there. Like I never had intentions of like going to grad school or like going to like the number one sociology PhD program. That was not in my fucking playbook. But like I think, and I think this kind of goes with like going and being in a flop era, like I was definitely flopping. And so I think when your back is like up against the wall, you kind of just like, I don't know, like I felt like I had nothing to lose. I was just like going for it, and you know what, what's the worst that could happen?
It's a good place to be in sometimes, to like recognize like your, maybe not like failures in this sense, but like what's not working. It's like you also went into Stanford as a computer science person, and I think sociology is oftentimes viewed as like entirely different, but I think this is just like the physics and the reality of life, where it's like if you're up, like sometimes the only direction is down, but that's not necessarily like a bad thing. It's like you you work the other side of your brain.
But I don't know, I mean, yeah, that's just my take on things. Like I think I really do want to like peak every decade. I like kind of have a plan to do that, like, because I'm, you know, very Capricorn, so I do actually have a concrete plan of how exactly I'm going to peak every decade. But so I'm working on it, but like I think, yeah. And then one thing I wanted to say too is that like it's interesting that we're talking about this because actually like next week I'm going to be like interviewing like high schoolers applying to Stanford this year, like undergrad admissions.
Tell me about that, 'cause like dude, I never had to do an interview for Stanford, but I did interviews for other schools, and some of my interviewers were just so mean, assholes. Like I was like sick, okay, so I'm not going to Harvard because this white man told me that basically I'm not a white man. I wouldn't thrive
Yeah,
here.
I mean, I think, well, okay, so what's crazy is that when I was interviewing, I remember like this was an interview for Yale, and we ended up like, so we like met up at a coffee shop, but he was like, oh, like, do you want to just like walk and talk? I was like, yeah, for sure. I like prefer that. You know, I hate just like sitting
Nice.
there. And we were like walking through a cemetery, and like we were like looking at like headstones, and he was like, yeah, you know, like none of this really matters at the end of the day. And I was like, I love that. And
Getting
you know, I
straight to
ended up
the
getting
point.
it.
We all die, so
And then I had other interviews that were like more normal, I guess. But yeah, I think I like, I'm just, yeah, I'm just curious about, I don't know, like we're in such like an, you know, like I feel like it was already bad when we were applying to school, but it's just only gotten worse. Like the anxiety that like families and like kids have these days, because they, I think the problem, again, going back to like peaking too early, like I think the problem is actually systemic, because like we view your entire first 18 years of your life as like going to college, and like it's so important to go to like Ivy League or Stanford or MIT, and like that's the only thing, you know, you can do. So a lot of people base their entire like, you know, self-worth on that, and then you're so exhausted by the time you even start at a school like Stanford that like obviously like people just kind of like stop caring so much, you know, and stop working as hard to like, you know, actually learn. And so I totally get that. And so I don't know, I
I
think
was
like,
recovering from burnout. I think like the first
yeah,
2 years of
I'm
Stanford, while just
burned
like trying to figure it out, I was like, wait, I burned myself out so bad in high school just trying to get here. And
out.
then now you want me to like choose a major and think about like what's gonna happen? Like, what the
Yeah, I
fuck?
think that's the problem. Like, I feel like most of my time at Stanford, at least undergrad, was like wasted on being burnt out from getting to Stanford. Like, and I think that just goes with like, okay, you graduate from Stanford and then you go work at like the consulting job or the investment banking job, but then you're so burnt out from getting that job that like you're hating it during it. So it's like, when does that like end, you know? So anyway, so I just want to talk to high schoolers. My goal for it is just to like get a vibe from them, obviously, just like see like what they're like out there, and also just to like do what I can to like, I don't know, like help ease their anxieties about their futures. Because I'm like, guys, like you're 17 or maybe 18, like it's just
Yeah,
like
and you're pretty
you don't have
harmless
a problem right
too.
now.
Yeah, it's like as long as you don't like kill someone or like
You're gonna be okay.
defraud people of like millions of dollars or whatever, like just enjoy the ride, you know, develop some interests in
Yeah,
the
exactly.
process. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
it.
exactly. Yeah, like again, like, I think it just goes back to like process versus outcome. Like it, like you can't blame people for like being so fixated on like getting a certain outcome, but like, I mean, you can still get the outcome and it still might not be like the experience that you thought it would be, and like you still have to go through the process of like finishing, like graduating from college, which at certain points I was like, well, I mean, I didn't even graduate on time. Like I literally took 6 years to finish my undergrad. I mean, and luckily, you know, the privilege of going to a school like Stanford is that I still got my ass covered, because I just like covered the extra 2 years by getting a master. So on paper, it looks like, you know, I got 2 degrees from 6 years. But the reality was that like I took 6 years to get my undergrad degree, because I was not finishing in 4 years. Like it was just not happening. So I think like, yeah, you know, like I think that's the problem with yeah, just like our incentive structures, like just
It's a
so
matter of perspective too, because I hear that and I'm like, that's impressive. You got your master's and your undergraduate degree in 6 years. And then meanwhile, I think you might say about that, like, yeah, it took me 6 years. That's like 2 years longer than me. Or like,
yeah.
not, sorry, like, well, yes, me, because I did four, but I
Normal.
didn't do like a co-term. But also, I think the other thing too sometimes is like, I remember my parents begging me not to take time off I finished in 4 years, but I was also sometimes like, at what cost to my mental
Yeah.
health, you know? And then I started like a job at Google like literally 2 days later, and I only stayed in that role for 3 months because I felt like it was rushed. I was like, this is not what I want to do. I can't see myself doing this longer. You get another brand name, but like, what is the actual intrinsic value? And I didn't
Yeah.
really feel like there was any, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. I think, yeah, like, I think, yeah, it's just sad. I mean, like, one thing that I always think about is like, I don't know, like, I think the problem's actually worse for like higher, like the kinds of students who like do end up getting into these like elite schools, because then you're like constantly chasing after like what you think of is successful, and like it kind of crowds out like more creative thought about like you don't have to follow necessarily what's successful like on paper. Like what success means is very different for everyone else, like for different people. You always have to like actually do a lot of like self work, internal work, and actually know like what your strengths are and like play to that. Like why like sort of follow these like external metrics? Like if it happens that like your actual strengths are in what investment banking can help you cultivate, then like yeah, for sure go for it. But like I doubt that that's everyone. Like it seems, you know, like
Yeah, or
so
like
I think,
chasing
yeah.
lists, like you know, like even the way our schools are ranked, like the US News list, like, and then there's like the Forbes list, like you graduate, and like I was in marketing and branding. It's like these lists are pay to play, so you
Yeah.
got to think about that too. It's like
Yeah.
it does kind of start to feel a little bit fake too. A degree, if you really care about it, and I think like you're doing something that you're proud of, it's like being on the Forbes list. I think as someone who's doing something really innovative and like women's healthcare is gonna feel really different than like someone who's just doing it just because they want recognition or and they have like enough money to pay for it. Like, I don't know, 'cause I've met both types of people, you know? Yeah.
I'm like curious, like, because I feel like, yeah, like I'm curious, like when you like when you're like talking to people, maybe like someone that you know, loosely keep in touch with, like as you've heard or something. Like, do you ever like meet people who you like tell them what you've been up to, and like you kind of like receive judgment like from them because it's not like what's normal considered, you
All
know,
the
normal
time.
expected of you. Yeah.
All the time. I would also get shade from people when I went to Maui, where they would, I think they would kind of like bully me a little bit sometimes, like working in like the gym or yoga spaces, because they're like, oh, why are you not like working in tech? I'm like, if you've ever worked in tech, especially like doing what I do, it's not fun. It like a lot of people want to be doing this actually, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. But I think sometimes people do have this like high school mentality where they want it, they're looking for insecurities. They want you to feel bad about yourself. And so I think like the most, like the biggest power move is not really like feeling bad about your choices. It's like loving them
Yeah.
regardless of like what people think, 'cause it's hard to be manipulated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely, yeah, I think it's funny because like I feel like I think like most of my like friends or people I keep in touch with from Stanford, they like get it and they're like, yeah, like that's awesome that you're like, you know, doing grad school. And then it's interesting though because like I feel like when I like ever like reconnect with, you know, someone who I haven't talked to for a long time since high school, I think the reaction I get is sometimes like more judgmental because yeah, like I think people tend to view like sociology as like a downgrade from computer science. There's like this really fucked up like glorification of STEM in our society in general. They're like, you're considered smart if you do STEM, and if you do anything not STEM, you're not smart. Like that's kind of the trope.
That's like
And
high grade idiocy to me. So
yeah,
I'm like, what?
because like
Yeah.
if we're really doing that kind of like petty whatever, I actually think some of like I think like I don't know, just being able to think critically that like a perspective from like a social scientist would give you, it's like a different kind of smartness. Like you can't really compare it, but like it's just like it's like people think that like I like went off the deep end,
Dude,
like that's
maybe
not
I did, but like, maybe
yeah
I
what about
did.
it
Yeah.
like
But also, the other thing, too, is like, I just think that's so not true. Like, as someone who really knows you, and I do wonder, like, does that kind of bother you? Like, what other people think if they think you went off the deep end? Because you like do so much for like yourself and your community and like people in your life. I think that is so much more important than the perception of people who care so little about things that really matter.
Yeah, I think it used to bother me more. I mean, I would definitely be lying if like I didn't care at all about like how people perceive me, because like I do. Like the thing is, like I know what I'm capable of. I know I'm very smart, and like I don't want people. I hate when people think I'm dumb, and I don't want people to think that. And so, but I think ultimately I'm not super worried about it, because actually, like, I am definitely trying to play like the long game, where it's like, okay, right now, like you think I'm a nobody because you are making all this money at your bank or tech job, and I'm like a grad student and you know whatever. But like I kind of plan on playing the long game, because like ultimately, like I do want to be a professor. Like I am going to be tenured, I'm going to have a lifetime job, I might even get pension when I'm older, because if I work at a public university, like I just have like different goals in life. And I think like I'm really happy with the choices I made. So ultimately I'm like, it's fine. And I think like it's, yeah. So it's both like I'm happy with the choices I made, but also I am definitely, I do feel like I have something to prove, and like I plan on doing that. So that's why I'm okay with
It's
it.
good fuel, if anything. Like sometimes I'll take people's sly little remarks and just save that for later when I need motivation. And
Yeah.
that's another way I'm hardwired, unfortunately. 'Cause I would be lying too if I said that what like older men at my job think doesn't matter to me. Like that's a lie. Like I do care 'cause like I worked really hard to like even make a switch from something like working in the social sciences and like talking about cities to then like basically being a tradesperson, Yeah, and but I like what I do. I like being able to have ideas and then like execute. It's so satisfying. Yeah, that was like something I made a choice for myself. And I felt lonely in that decision as well, but I meet people all the time who like make switches and I'm proud of them. If anything, I'm like, you like really believe that you could do this and you put in the work to do it. That's so cool.
So anyways, yeah, so those are just my thoughts on that.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I value your thoughts and opinions so much, and I'm happy to have you on the podcast again. Yay, thank you for joining me today. I'm gonna
Yeah, for
stop.
sure. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on again. Yeah.